thank you very much indeed. Well, why is religious freedom special, or should it be special? Now, whenever I talk about this subject, I usually find that if I look at the newspaper that day or the day before, there's some big item, usually on the front page, that's directly to do with what I want to talk about. And that just illustrates the fact that this is really something of an incendiary subject, that it actually, on both sides of the Atlantic, is arising quite a lot of problems. Now, on the front page yesterday of the Sunday Times, under the title No Faith, Hope or Charity, Church Status in Jeopardy, there was a report that the Charity Commission has warned that the Church of England and other churches cannot be assumed to be acting for the good of the public, prompting fears of a politically correct campaign against Christianity. A letter, when this was all before a parliamentary committee last week, and a lot of the MPs were rather concerned about it, a letter from the Commission's head of legal services, referring to a tribunal case which was concerned particularly Plymouth Brethren, said, "This decision makes it clear there was no presumption that religious generally, or at any more specific level, is for the public benefit, even in the case of Christianity or the Church of England." Now, this all goes back to the change in the law in 2006, when no longer in English charity law was there to be a presumption that religion is itself a reasonable basis for charitable exemptions. I mean, up to that point, religion and education were thought themselves to be exempt from any kind of questioning about whether they really were charitable. If you were religious, genuinely religious, then that was it. You proved the point. There were arguments about whether the Church of Scientology was a genuine religion, but if it was a genuine religion, that was the end of the argument. Now, in 2006, the law was changed so that no longer was there a presumption in favour of religion, but that there was actually a test for charitable status of public benefit. Now, I think at the time, a lot of people felt that this was actually aimed more at independent schools than anything else, and perhaps private medicine too, that there was a feeling that independent schools were gaining tax exemptions and were they actually contributing to the good of society, and it was all part of the Labour government's general squeezing of independent education. But of course, in the same bill with the came the narrowing of the presumption of religion as being a public good, in fact a lessening or even a removal of that presumption, and in the end we're faced with the question that religion has to prove that it is actually publicly benefiting society. To give a particular example, the Church Missionary Society, I would have thought a rather respectable body, had to expend a considerable amount of time and effort proving to the Charity Commission a couple of years ago that it was actually working for public benefit. Now, if you remember, the Church Missionary Society was founded by William Wilberforce, amongst others, and I would have thought it had a rather good pedigree for charitable work, but not according to the present Charity Commission. It needed to be tested. Well, in the end, the Church Missionary Society did win through. But the problem with this is that tests are now being set that religion has to pass. In other words, the state is setting standards of judgment. Instead of saying, we want a pluralist society, we're not saying this religion or that religion is good, this denomination or that denomination, but religion as such is something we want to encourage. Therefore, if you're religious, we want to encourage it. Instead of that, there's the assumption growing that actually religion is rather questionable. It might actually be positively harmful. It has to prove that it isn't. I was actually just spending some time this afternoon in the law library here reading in a current periodical the fact that in Australia they're actually at the moment agonising about whether to change current charity law to something more like what happens in England. In other words, the phrase public benefit is coming in to federal level instead of the idea that religion is presumed to be a good thing for society or religion. Now, I suppose one reason for this is the growth of radical Islam, and that gives a possibility for some people to say, hey, wait a minute, we don't want to encourage every form of religion, let's look at what's going on. But I think much more likely is that here we have an instance of the increasing secularism of European society and British society. So we have, and secularism comes in many shapes and sizes, and you can mean anything by it, but what I'm meaning by secularism here is a rather belligerent form of secularism that says actually religion is very suspect, it's a divisive thing, it's possibly a source of violence, we have to have protection from religion. Religion has to prove itself. We can't assume it's a public good. In fact, we assume probably that it isn't a public good. So this whole business about charity and charitable status is part of, I think, a wider cultural movement in our society, which no longer takes for granted the fact that religion as such is a good, or that a claim to exercise religion, a claim in legal language to manifest it, is itself something that carries much weight. Now, as I said, Europe, it's, well, it's becoming aggressively secular. The Council of Europe, different from the European Union, but it's the setup that controls the European Court of Human Rights and covers the whole of Europe, including Russia, they see human rights, in one report, as being in opposition to religion rather than being underwritten by it. And that's a very prevalent Enlightenment view that's coming in. It's the later French Enlightenment. Religion is the enemy. It's not the early American Enlightenment, but Enlightenment, which saw religion as very much the basis of society and, in fact, perhaps the basis for our belief in human freedom and why human freedom is important. But the later French Enlightenment was much more explicitly anti-religious. And so the Council of Europe, influenced, I think, still by present-day France and by the rather anti-clerical attitude of Spain, sees the separation of church and state, and I quote, as one of Europe's shared values. I don't think it is, because a lot of European states don't separate church and state like that. But still, they say, nor may states allow the dissemination of religious principles which, if put into practice, would violate human rights. If doubts exist in this respect, states must require, note the word require, religious leaders to take an unambiguous stand in favour of the precedence of human rights over any religious principle. The precedence of rights over any religious principle. In other words, you have an opposition already between rights and religion. Rights upholding the autonomy and equality of people. Religion as authoritarian, obscurantist, irrational, whatever words you want to throw at it. And this is the Council of Europe, in representing all parliaments in Europe. And I find that exceedingly worrying, that a particular view of human rights, a rather biased view, is being adopted as, in a sense, the official view. And as a result, religion is being marginalised, pushed in a corner, even privatised. And as a result, appeals to human rights will always trump any appeal to religious principle. Now, I just think that it's wrong to separate the two like that. I think human rights are based on religious principles myself. I mean, why are humans important if you, in the end, don't start talking about us being made in the image of God? You've got to find some other reason why humans have a particular dignity, why humans matter rather than, say, animals. And just saying, well, that's how we think, or that isn't good enough. Plenty of people, even in Europe in my lifetime, haven't believed that. But nowadays, there's a great tendency for equality to trump appeals to freedom, appeals to equality, equal treatment, not giving precedence to one view over another. And there are plenty of instances of that happening at the moment. If I can just give an instance across the Atlantic, we're just facing tomorrow the presidential election. One feature of the last few months in America has been a very heated argument about Obamacare, and particularly the way in which it, in fact, seems to be accepting that people, and institutions particularly, can be forced to act against their conscience in providing insurance cover for various things that they disapprove of, abortion, contraception, etc. And a lot of people object, and they say, look, I mean, for instance, Catholic institutions shouldn't be caught up in this, they should be able to opt out. And again, the state, therefore, is making a decision about what is good for people, and it's riding roughshod over other people's conscientious objections to that. And this is one thing I want to raise tonight, is just the question as to whether we really want always the state to be the final arbiter of what's right and wrong, with no opt-outs for people, no ability to have objections from the point of view of conscience, no respect for conscience, no respect for religious principle. Instead, we have very much a creeping, aggressive secularism that is driving religion slowly but surely out of public life. Another example this side of the Atlantic, which occurred earlier in the year, you may have read about, the town council in Biddeford in North Devon were in the custom of saying prayers at the start of their meetings. Not so very surprising. I mean, the House of Commons does it every day, the House of Lords does it every day. But an objection came from the National Secular Society, and it was eventually upheld in court. Now, of course, the government have tried to overrule it, but I notice a lot of councils are playing safe and saying, well, perhaps we wouldn't have prayers, we don't want court cases about this. It didn't matter that they'd had prayers in Biddeford since the time of Elizabeth I. It didn't matter that the great majority of councillors had voted democratically to continue them. It didn't matter that nobody was being coerced to take part in them. They could stand outside and go in after. Perfectly proper. I was actually attending a debate in the House of Lords a few days ago, and guests going up into the public galleries have to wait outside while a bishop reads the prayers for 5 minutes or so at the start of the session. The prayers are private, just for members. And I noticed when I was waiting that quite a few members, though a lot of people had gone in, I mean, I was surprised how many people would made it a point to attend for prayers, quite a few people arrived and were standing to wait to go in after. Now, some of them may have been doing it for conscientious reasons. They didn't want any truck with prayers. Some of them may have just been late after lunch. Nobody bothered, and there were lots of reasons why people would suddenly bustle up 5 minutes after. And there was a break after prayers while everybody was ushered in and people went into the public galleries. No coercion. Those who wanted to attended, those who didn't, no feeling of first or second class citizens at all. And yet it was something that was a historic practice and meant a lot to many people. Now, a lot of people nowadays would say, no, the public square must be neutral, and by neutral we mean we don't have religion in it. Not just that we don't have coercion. And therefore, people should not therefore be able to have prayers. Freedom is not having religion forced down our throats, even if it isn't. And it isn't in any sense a kind of assault on freedom to say to people, you can't have prayers even if you want to. Other notable disputes that have occurred, well, there's one which I think is a classic one, the civil registrar in Islington in London, Lillian Liddell, who objected to administering and ceremonies for civil partnerships. Now, in all of these cases, the issue isn't, do you agree with her? And I mean, I think it's very, you may think, yes, I'd stand with her, or you may think she's making a fuss about nothing, or you may think, actually, she's wrong. It doesn't matter what you think about this. That isn't the issue. It isn't, is her view of civil partnerships right? It is that she has a sincere belief about them. Should you respect that belief, or should she be forced either to act against the belief or give up her job? In her case, she gave up her job. Now, and there was no issue about either civil partnerships not being able to be solemnized in there, because there are other colleagues who could do it. It was a big place. Islington have a lot of registrars. It was quite easy to say, oh, well, you just do that other one, I'll do this one. They could have arranged it to suit her conscience. But oh no, Islington Council wanted to make a point. And the point they wanted to make was that in any sense discriminating against homosexuals and civil partnerships in that way was against their policy. It was discrimination with a capital D, and they were not going to allow it. Now, the problem is that all declarations of human rights, the European view of human rights, the United Nations view, etc., all of them maintain that religious freedom is a basic right, and that we have perhaps a qualified right to manifest it, but nevertheless the presumption should be that we can manifest our religion. In this, I think probably Europe's a bit different from the United States, because in the United States the First Amendment does actually talk of free exercise of religion. And it's of religion too, not just religion nor belief, which you get on this side of the Atlantic. And a lot of people would say, well, it is actually first in the Bill of Rights in America for a reason, that actually all democratic rights stem from religious freedom. I think it's worth pausing there just for a moment to think about that, because I do feel that if you can't live according to what you think is most important, if you can't, in a sense, act in accordance with it, there is a question about how far you're really able to contribute to any democratic discussion. If I find that I can't mention my religion, I can't bring my religious views into public life, I can't act in accordance with them, then aren't I being constrained so that actually I'm not bringing the full weight of my judgment to bear on the democratic discussion that's taking place? That religion seems to, and by religion here, let me include opposition to religion too. I mean that I protect the atheist, the agnostic, as well as the person putting forward a religion. But views about what is most fundamental in life actually matter when we're talking about what's important in a society, what's good in a society, what's bad in a society. It will influence everything else. So if you have no religious freedom, have you really got much democratic freedom? Now, this is a real issue, of course, when you look at places like China, where religious freedom is extremely qualified, and I think that any country like that, which doesn't really allow religious freedom, therefore is probably restricting democracy in a very, very great way. In fact, that's probably one reason why they're afraid of religion, because they don't want a challenge to the basic authority of the state. One point about religion, of course, always, is that religion is positing the existence of something beyond this world, something transcendent, characteristically, against which perhaps this world can be judged. So a typical religious view is saying that there is something higher than the authority of the state, and I have allegiance to that before I have allegiance to the state. And that's a very uncomfortable view for many states. It's a devastating view for a totalitarian state, which is why you will never find a totalitarian state happy with allowing religion, unless they control the religion absolutely and use it as their tool. But genuine free religion is always a threat to the authority of a state, because one's allegiance isn't ultimately to the state. Of course, at its extreme, you can see in 17th century philosophy, for instance, John Locke using that kind of argument to say, actually, this might even justify revolt against an unjust ruler, an unjust tyrant, that it could actually, and the Americans used this in 1776, of course, that it actually could justify standing against a regime that you think is wrong in some way, because there are standards of what's right and wrong independent of those set by the state. Now, notice that that isn't the view that you get in places even like France, which of course is a democracy, because there, with its revolutionary background, la laïcité, as it's called, a kind of secularist attitude, I mean, the very name laïcité suggests that it's an anti-clerical view, is opposed to seeing the authority of anything resting beyond the state. They don't want the church telling them what to do. They don't want bishops telling them what to do. They certainly don't want the Pope telling them what to do. And it was for that reason, I think, that there was an argument, of course, about when the Lisbon Treaty was being argued about in the European Union, about whether there should be any reference to Christianity in the preamble. And the French, amongst others, didn't want any specific reference to Christianity. They didn't want to acknowledge the Christian heritage of Europe. And unfortunately, when the Pope of the time intervened, well, that was the last straw, because they certainly weren't going to do what the Pope said. So there's just a vague reference to the kind of religious and humanist inheritance of Europe, but no reference to Christianity as such. Because there is a deep distrust of alternative sources of authority. Well, perhaps structures of authority leading back to the Vatican might be one thing, but they're also a distrustful of any appeal to God as such as well. Yeah. So I think that democracy requires freedom, and freedom to decide what's important, and that means, above all, freedom of religion. So I would say, actually, yes, I would agree with those Americans who say that the first freedom, the freedom of religion, isn't just that because it comes first in a document. It comes first in the document because many of the American founders realized it was absolutely fundamental importance. People like James Madison saw that without religious freedom, freedom itself was being restricted. Well, back to the Civil Registrar and the Supreme Court, and then going on to the European Court of Human Rights. She, as I said, lost her job because the state is deciding that, in fact, what is important, non-discrimination, equal rights for gays, rather than respect for any religious view. In other words, in a clash between a right to manifest religion and a right not to be discriminated against, then, in fact, the whole thing comes down absolutely in favour of non-discrimination. But there's an irony there. This case, along with three others you may be aware of, has gone to the European Court of Human Rights, and the hearing was in September. I would imagine that we'll hear, maybe before Christmas, of what the result of it is. There were two concerned with issues about homosexuality and civil kind of the wish for conscientious opt-outs in dealing with homosexuals of one kind or another, and two were about the wearing of religious symbols. There was the case of the British Airways worker who insisted on wearing a cross and was told that all religious symbols were forbidden by British Airways, and she insisted and she lost her job. In the end, British Airways gave way, but the case has gone on rumbling through the courts. I gather a twist to that was that she actually comes from the Coptic Church. She wasn't just C of E or something like that. And there's a special emphasis on wearing a cross. So it was particularly important to her. Other cases, the one, for instance, that came to the Supreme Court concerned a Jewish school. And the Jewish school was told that it was involved in discrimination because it was refusing to accept people who weren't Jews according to its own criteria. And so that was racial discrimination, open and shut case. Racial discrimination, absolutely wrong, will always trump everything else, doesn't matter about religion. In fact, of course, some people would use that as a good argument because they'd say, oh, well, I mean, just because religious people believed in apartheid doesn't mean you could respect that. So it's quite right that religion is kept in its place. But there did seem to be a very suspect invasion of what, in fact, people would believe was really right for a court to be doing. They started saying what a Jew should be defined as. The court case started off by quoting Deuteronomy, and I think once judges start delving into Deuteronomy, you think, well, something's going wrong. Aren't they getting outside their realm of expertise? And this is a genuine problem here. You find very often judges start talking about, this is not a core belief, that is not a religious requirement. Now, who are they to say? And I think this is a real problem, particularly when they're dealing with Christians, because judges seem to think they know about Christianity, even when it's obvious they don't. In the case of wearing a cross, the woman was told, well, you know, it's not a requirement for Christians to wear crosses. Rather peculiar view, because obviously a cross has got something to do with Christianity. I remember earlier in the year, there was an Anglo-Saxon burial site that was discovered near Cambridge, and it was said that it was an Anglo-Saxon princess about 680 AD, but people got very excited because she was wearing a cross, and it was therefore obviously a sign of one of the very early Christian Anglo-Saxon burial. Now, the interesting thing about that was the fact she was wearing a cross showed she was a Christian. A cross and Christianity were indelibly entwined. And yet, when we get to the court, we say, you don't have to wear a cross if you're a Christian. What are you going on about? Lose your job if you just, it's a bit of jewellery. That's all it is. So the courts are deciding what's important. In the Lillian Adele case about civil partnership, she was told, beliefs about marriage are not a core belief for a Christian. Now, that's quite an astonishing remark, actually, if you think about it. I would have thought beliefs about marriage probably are. I mean, the whole relationship between Christ and the church in the New Testament is drawn on analogy with marriage between man and woman. But at any rate, whether it is or it isn't, we can argue about theologically. But it isn't for judges in an English court to say what is a central part of Christianity and what isn't. And yet that's what they're doing. And I think that itself is very worrying. Now, why is this? One thing that becomes very apparent when you're reading law cases, and one reason why religious freedom isn't being taken seriously, is that religion itself isn't being taken seriously. I've already mentioned at the beginning that the whole business about charitable law shows that actually they're not taking religion as itself a public good anymore, which always used to be the position. But worse now, you'll find that in the English courts, you'll find that statements are being made about Christianity and about religion that I take very great exception to. Now, there's Lord Justice Laws, this is 2010, in a case that's been actually already quoted in several other cases. So, because, of course, English law goes on precedent. Once a senior judge says something, it can be picked up by the judges, and it really gets built into the whole structure of law. And he says that, in the eye of everyone save the believer, religious faith is necessarily subjective. It's incommunicable by any kind of proof or evidence. The ascertainment of such a truth lies beyond the means by which laws are made in a reasonable society. It lies only in the heart of the believer who is alone bound by it. Now, I find that very worrying, and I speak now as a philosopher of religion, and I've written a lot on faith and reason. There he's actually denying that faith is reasonable, that faith is a matter of reason. I think faith has to be a matter of reason, because there's always faith in something, and once you specify what it's in, you're using your reason. But for him, faith is something subjective. He's saying that it's not communicable by any kind of proof or evidence. That sounds, you know, when I was an undergraduate here, I was taught by A.J. Ayer, I mean, some of you may have heard of him. He was the kind of Richard Dawkins of his time, in a way, always on television attacking religion. A brilliant philosopher, but with a bee in his bonnet about religion and its falsity. Or at least his position was actually more subtle than that. Very often he would say it wasn't false, it was meaningless. Unless you can verify or falsify a religious statement, it has no meaning at all. In other words, anything that has meaning is within the reach of modern science. If you can't prove it scientifically, if there's no scientific evidence, it has no meaning. I think that kind of view went very deep. Now, it doesn't hold up in philosophy. I don't want to get onto the philosophy of science, but it just doesn't hold up for physics nowadays, because there are plenty of things that physics deals with that are theoretical, and physics wants to posit their reality, but it hasn't got any direct way of showing that these things exist. You just need them for the theory. And there are plenty of things that are probably in principle beyond our scope. The other side of the universe, interior of a black hole, there are lots of things. But you may still want to say they are there. And as a realist, I'd say, well, there is such a thing as reality, even if we don't know it. But for this, you see that Ayres verificationism, logical positivism, stemming from the Vienna Circle before the war, was really echoing on through the decades, and it's still appearing in English law, that actually the idea is that these things aren't susceptible to proof. Because, I mean, he's not just saying the law courts can't decide what's true here, it's not within our scope. I mean, that certainly is true. He's saying, actually, because there's no proof or evidence, they're not the kind of thing that have any objectivity. They're of pure subjective validity. I think he's a bit confused about it all, but the tenor of what he's saying is basically that religion is not rational. It's something that one can adopt, be committed to oneself, but that's all. I mean, my religion is my faith is mine, yours is yours, but that's all you can say about it. All you need is faith. It doesn't matter what it's faith in, it's faith. And a lot of people talk like that nowadays. They talk about faith without saying what it's faith in, when what it's faith in rather matters. But this is creeping into law as well. And so it means that religion isn't really taken seriously as something that's claiming truth about the world and about reality. It's not something that can therefore take part in public discussion. It's not something that can be argued against, too, because, of course, one point about saying it's subjective and shouldn't be brought into public view is that it's fenced around you, it's invulnerable. And, I mean, one thing I would say is that, of course, not all religion is good religion. I've been talking about religion. I'm not just talking about Christianity at the moment here. And some religion is pretty nasty. So just because something is motivated by religion doesn't of itself prove it's all right. But it ought to be out in the public square for us to examine it and see whether it is good or whether it isn't. And I mean, that, of course, is the kind of argument that some people would use to say, well, therefore, that's why we want to discount religion completely. But I think religion ought to be given the chance to show that it is of value and it is good. It is saying something important. So I'm against what Lord Justice Law has said about religion being protected is to actually, therefore, to prefer the subjective over the objective. Religion is making claims to objective truth, and that's why it's important. Either God exists or God doesn't. And there are perhaps reasons for saying one or the other. And one can talk about revelation as well. One way of restricting the notion of religious freedom is not to actually allow a lot of things to be manifestations of religion. There is a big argument about this. I mean, is Muslim dress a manifestation of religion or a cultural practice? Even Muslims would disagree about that. But there has been a tendency on both sides of the Atlantic to restrict freedom of religion to freedom of worship, to narrow what counts as religion. So Lillian Adele, in that case of the civil registrar, was told, you've got freedom of religion, you're free to worship as you wish. It doesn't matter that she couldn't do her job and keep to her religious principles, because religion is just taking part in certain rituals on a Sunday or whenever. And actually, funnily enough, even that isn't protected, although you might think it ought to be, because there are a lot of cases nowadays about Sunday working, and the courts are remarkably unsympathetic to people who want not to work on Sunday or Saturday or Friday, because, in fact, they want to worship according to their religion. Instead, they're told that they have freedom of religion because, and this is the European Court's official view, they have freedom of religion because they have freedom of contract. In other words, of course you can worship as you wish on Sunday because you can give up your job. You don't have to work. Now, I don't think the freedom to be unemployed is much of a freedom, and yet that's the kind of freedom that people are being offered. In other words, if you want to worship, then give up everything else. We're not protecting your right to worship. So even if you restrict freedom of religion to freedom of worship, which Obama and on this side of the Atlantic various political leaders have tended to do sometimes, you notice they talk about freedom of worship, not freedom of religion, and they mean to be saying that. Therefore, when you get that kind of thing, even freedom of worship itself isn't being protected enough. But basically what I'm saying is that, I start off by talking about human rights, even though there's no hierarchy of rights, so we're told, we find again and again the right to religious freedom, the right to manifest one's religion, is trumped by other rights, in particular equality over freedom. That was basically the theme of the book I've wrote this year. And equality always wins over religious freedom. And yet there's no real reason why it should. Indeed, even if you take the line about discrimination, an interesting thing is, if you're discriminating against somebody on the grounds of their sexual orientation, but that is a result of your religious principles, and you're told you can't, isn't that discrimination against you on religious grounds? In other words, however you solve that, there's a balance there, discrimination against religion, discrimination on sexual orientation. But that isn't how the law sees it. They just don't bother about the one side of discrimination. That actually is a line that was taken by one of the barristers in the European Court in September. And it'll be interesting to see what the European Court make of that. Perhaps they will say, yes, this is a religious discrimination. If you think there is a balance of rights there, and that each has a claim, one way out of it is, and this is a term of art really, reasonable accommodation. That's sometimes used in particular cases of disability, where you can accommodate disability, but in a reasonable way. You don't have to pull down a church tower because people can't go up it if they're in a wheelchair, or close it to everybody else. So you can be reasonable, but you should accommodate if you can. At the moment, there's no reasonable accommodation for religious freedom time and time again. There's no attempt to say, well, we respect your view, but we must give this service. Let's try and do both. They'll say, no, we give the service. We're not having people like you casting aspersions. That's it. So, again, you see that what was happening is you've got this later Enlightenment prejudice against religion, the secularizing tendency to think that religion is something that must be got out of public life. We must have religion, in a sense, exercised. We must have freedom from religion. I'm arguing actually we need freedom for religion. I would have a more positive view about religion, partly because I think in a pluralist society with lots of different views, people with different views ought to be able to contribute to debates about the common good. Some oughtn't to be shut up. Now, should there be exemptions made for a religious conscience, even from neutral laws? I mean, that's the question hovering over all this. Do you just have one law for everybody, or do you start having exemptions? And once you start exemptions, isn't that very dangerous? Because it means in the end the whole system of law can collapse if everybody says, ah, well, no, I've got conscientious objections to that. I mean, you're not going to take seriously people who say, I've got a serious religious objection to paying my taxes. So at what point do you draw the line? Well, of course, already we do make exemptions. Sikhs don't have to wear crash helmets on motorbikes, for instance. Sikhs don't have to wear helmets as policemen. They can still wear their own headgear. There are other examples where we do try and respect people's conscience when it's possible. And I think that might be certainly perfectly in order. So I think that one ought to think much more seriously about the role of religious conscience in society and the fact that it actually should be protected if possible. Well, let me just sum up a bit. Why is religious freedom special? I mean, in a sense, I suppose it comes down to the question, why is religion special, but that there's a great tendency amongst a lot of thinkers and people contributing to this kind of debate to want religion out of the subject. They'll say, well, yeah, religious freedom is all important, but only because it's conscience. So it's everybody's conscience. So, for instance, if somebody wants Saturday off to go and worship because they're, say, a Seventh-day Adventist, why should you respect that and not somebody who has some other conscience-driven view? Perhaps they passionately follow Manchester United, and therefore it's against their principles not to see a match. Well, that's a ludicrous example, perhaps, but you can see that if people feel deeply about something, that's not enough. So how do you decide what is enough or not? If you talk about religion, well, that does fence it round a bit, because we know roughly what a religion is. I've said that religion is important because it encapsulates what people think important in life, and that needs particular protection against more trivial concerns. Institutions as well as individuals need protection. There's a great tendency in our modern liberal, inverted commas, society to talk about the autonomy of individuals, to protect individual rights to this, that, and the other. To think religion is subjective, it's a matter of personal choice. A lot of religious education in schools goes on this line. But there is a communal aspect to religion and an institutional aspect. Religious institutions are important in a democratic society. A democratic society that exists on nothing between the state and the individual is in a very dangerous position, because actually in the end the state is going to get more and more power to regulate what goes on between individuals. And you can see that happening in our society. You need an intermediate level of institutions. And in our society at the moment, particularly in this country, a lot of them are being undermined. The churches are weaker, but are being deliberately undermined in many ways. But so are other institutions, trade unions, political parties, you name it. People are much less willing to come together. And yet, civil society, as you might call it, is very necessary as a bulwark against the dominance of the state and as a way of providing a context in which individuals can live their lives. So, religious freedom isn't just a matter for individuals. It's also a matter of protecting institutions and respecting them. I could go into lots of examples where that, in fact, itself is not happening, where, for instance, modern employment law is being brought against people employed in churches, for instance, even clergy, and the right of churches even to control who they have as clergy can sometimes almost be put in question. It's something the Supreme Court in the United States earlier this year actually made a very strong statement about in a very significant case, and they did protect the right of institutions, in this case the Lutheran Church, to have control over its own clergy. Religion is always particularly vulnerable. It posits another source of authority. I've mentioned the fact that totalitarian states don't like religion. But for that reason, religion is always going to be attacked unless it's protected. It isn't something a state is ever going to be neutral about. A neutrality by the state is often going to mean a deep suspicion of religion. Another possibility is religion is just subject to the will of the people, to the democratic will, and that can be very shifting and itself very dangerous. We all know about the question of the dictatorship of the majority and the rights of minorities. One thing that, I could then devote the next hour to talking about, but I won't, is that religion is deeply rooted in human nature. Now, I've spent several years here as part of a project on the cognitive science of religion, and I was more on the philosophical and theological side about the meaning of some of the discoveries being made. The press got very impressed with it, not because they bothered about the subject, but because we got £2 million to do it. And they thought, well, if you get that amount of money, it must be important. the cognitive science of religion is stressing just how deeply rooted in human nature religion is, that amongst all children, all people at all times, you will find basic impulses that go to make up religion. Perhaps a belief in non-material agency, a belief in purpose, an instinctive belief in purpose. Children find it very easy first to think that their parents know everything, and then as they gradually understand, perhaps their parents don't know everything, they find it still easy to understand that God could. Now, I'm not saying that this is just a matter of indoctrinating children. I'm talking about the fact that children find it easy to think of these things. It goes with the grain of the way that we think. It's something to do with the cognitive architecture of the human mind. And so I could go on. There are lots of different instances of that where you'll find that religious views, in a sense, are very coupled with other notions of what it is to be human. The way humans think and their religious reactions to the world cannot be easily separated. Now, that's at a first level. I mean, you can stand back as you grew up and reason about religion and either think it's true or think it's false. But atheism is itself a second-order thing. It's like theology. I mean, theology is ruminating on all of this. But the basic impulse, very often, the first view can often be religious. Well, I don't want to enlarge on that for the moment, but let me just say that if that is true, then religion is always going to be present. It's always going to be a powerful motivation. It's not surprising that years of communism didn't eradicate it. The minute communism goes, religion is very much obvious again. Religion is always there. I remember an anthropologist saying to me, whenever he dug up a site of people of, say, a couple of thousand years ago, he knew that they had a religion even if he couldn't find any evidence of it left. And he was an atheist, but I mean, his attitude is, well, we're stuck with it, even though I don't like it. But the issue is it's there, and so it ought to be allowed out in the open in public life, and we ought to respect the impulses that arise from it. You can't change human nature in that way. Well, all I'm saying is that at the moment it's very obvious in our society that religion isn't being respected, but as a result, religious freedom isn't being respected, and that is dangerous itself for democracy. Thank you.